major teaching from the minor prophets. That's what we're offering today on Encounter God's Truth with Bible teacher Dr. John Whitcomb. We're opening part three of our ongoing study in the book of the prophet Zechariah called Zechariah, the Lord Remembers. Now, you can go back and listen to all of parts one and two, which were presented previously here on Encounter God's Truth, simply by visiting sermonaudio.com/Whitcomb. There you'll find all the teaching on the first eight chapters of this prophetic book. You'll learn how they're replete with great prophecies about the future fulfillment of all of God's promises to Israel when you visit sermonaudio.com/Whitcomb. Zechariah may be considered one of the minor prophets, but his book contains 14 chapters of detailed prophecies given to God's people in Judah following their return from exile in Babylon, a period that's covered in the books of Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. Dr. Whitcomb opens today with some introductory remarks, reminding us about the background of this book and its place within the Old Testament, and also within our understanding of biblical truth. I'm Wayne Shepherd, your host, emphasizing that God's Word is true from the beginning to the end, even when it teaches about the future kingdom of Israel. So here's Dr. Whitcomb to tell us more in part one of his message, The Salvation of Israel.
Now, friends, this evening we begin a series of studies in perhaps the most difficult prophetic portion of God's written Word, the final six chapters of the book of Zechariah. Chapters 9, 10, and 11, focusing upon Israel's relationship to her Gentile enemies. What is God going to do to Israel's enemies? And they're abounding, multiplying. Are they not even before our eyes today? Who could ever have believed, since at least I've been on this earth, and many of you, that Jews, thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions would be back into the promised land in unbelief, to be sure, but nevertheless positioned by the providence of God for spectacular, stupendous, supernatural events that could begin tonight, if you still believe like I do in a pre-tribulation rapture of the church. That means the 70th week of Daniel could, of course, begin tonight. And so the things that Zechariah prophesied 2,500 years ago are becoming scintillating, vibrating in their relevance for you and me today, as I trust you are a full, bona fide, 100% member of the body of Christ by His grace and mercy through the blood of Christ, and thus prepared for the rapture of the church and the inauguration of God's final program for Israel, the final outworking of the Abrahamic covenant for the people of Israel on the earth. Now, in this book of Zechariah, chapters 9, 10, and 11, then, the Gentile nations are being forewarned of what's going to happen to them, and Israel in that context. But chapters 12, 13, and 14 focus mostly on Jerusalem. That will be the center, the focus of the whole world, more than even it is today, if that can be imagined possible. Yes, that will be the burdensome stone, burdensome to all the nations of the world. They will hate everything Jerusalem has ever stood for, and the people that claim it under God for their nation and for their destiny. And God is going to vindicate Jerusalem, but not until He cleanses it and purifies it and brings genuine revival into the hearts of the people in the outworking of the new covenant. The ethnic Israelite aspect of the new covenant of Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and so forth, a prophecy that we just can hardly imagine actually happening on this earth. Now, friends, it's important for us to get a little bit of a picture here, if I may suggest to you, of what is happening at this phase of Bible history. The exiles of Judah and Jerusalem have been deported by God from their beloved land, their city burned, their temple smashed by Babylonian armies in several phases, as we'll see in a moment. But after 70 long years, exactly as Jeremiah had prophesied, they would return. But I'm sure Jeremiah would have been very discouraged to learn how few really had even a desire to return. A tiny remnant, comparatively speaking. Out of millions, only 50,000 came back. Under Zerubbabel, the governor, actually grandson of the final king, but therefore under his curse, according to Jeremiah 22, and he could never be a member of a royal family functioning as a king. And Joshua, the high priest, a legitimate descendant, of course, of the Zadokian priests, all the way back to the time of David and beyond. And that was a remarkable combination, you know, the two witnesses, as it were, that sort of anticipate for us in a remarkable way, the two witnesses that God will someday send to the earth. Here are the two olive trees that stand for the God of Israel, speaking forth authoritatively for him in a time of tremendous revival and return. But oh, so sad. Only 50,000 came back, not the whole nation, and there wasn't one supernatural event that took place in that return. And therefore, it can't possibly be the fulfillment of the Old Testament prophecies, like in Isaiah 11, etc., that the nation would someday come back to the promised land. No, friends, this was a pitiful remnant, a mere shadow of what had happened at the Exodus in Egypt and what will happen at the second coming of Christ in glory. Nevertheless, God honored this return. He honored Zerubbabel, the governor. He honored Joshua, the high priest, symbolically and directly and remarkably. They were godly men, but oh, friends, look at this. No sooner did they come back to the promised land than they found themselves totally surrounded by every conceivable kind of enemy and that threatened them. And they refused to compromise their convictions in some kind of an ecumenical enterprise whereby the enemies would have an equal share in rebuilding the temple and thus controlling it and contaminating it. And therefore, the enemies declared war on the remnant, and the whole program of rebuilding the temple ended with nothing but a foundation laid. That was in 536. Just a few short months after the return, according to the decree of Cyrus in 538. To rebuild the temple, he was very anxious for that temple to function. You know why? Even though he was a total pagan, probably a Zoroastrian, he had deep respect for the Jews and for their prophet that actually had named him 150 years in advance, Isaiah chapter 45. And I wonder if Daniel himself didn't show him that prophecy in the scroll of Isaiah. So he said, "Well, you Jews go back. I'm going to let you have all those precious temple vessels that Belshazzar, the final king of Babylon, had desecrated in the banquet hall, that final disastrous orgy. You take those vessels back," said Cyrus, "and I want everything you need to have a functioning temple. Because I want you to pray for me and my sons and for my empire." You see, he was a polytheist. He wanted to honor every god of every temple in his vast empire. And so he doubtless had special respect for the temple of the Jews, even though he was not a believer himself, according to Isaiah 45. He did not know the Lord personally. But of course, the people of Israel were overwhelmed by this generous decree of Cyrus, and as we've seen, many went back to rebuild the temple. Now, how could the enemies get away with that kind of thing when they knew Cyrus wanted the temple rebuilt? Well, he was hundreds and hundreds of miles away, and the enemies were desperate to have that program stopped because it was a threat to their own independent ambitions in Palestine. And of course we know, don't we, without even thinking about it for one moment, that behind them was Satan, who hates Israel. Always has, always will. And therefore they boldly risked retaliation by Cyrus and stopped the temple project dead. This is hard to imagine, folks. I mean, here are godly men, godly people, who for 16 years were in total despair. They just simply gave up, went back and built their own houses, and figured, well, we'll just have to postpone the work of the Lord until it's appropriate, convenient, till it's the right time, the fullness of time. Of course, it's never the right time to do the work of God if you don't want to. And that's what God finally told them through Haggai and Zechariah. Haggai, an older prophet, Zechariah, a younger one. Interesting how these two men were matched by those two men who revived their hearts and the hearts of the people, and the temple project was started again amidst enormous threats and opposition, but the work was continued through the prophesying and encouraging from God through Haggai and Zechariah. And finally it was finished in 516 BC, according to Ezra chapter 6. Victory at last. Now, friends, don't we want to sort of end the book of Ezra right there and say, well, and so Israel lived happily ever after? No. Any more than this magnificent conference is the kind of thing where we will leave, God willing, on Thursday noon saying, what a tremendous blessing and encouragement and uplifting and illuminating time this has been. We will all now live happily ever after. No. We have just two problems: Satan and our sin nature. Sorry about those. And friends, the book of Ezra does not even tell us what happened after the temple was finished. As the years went by, apparently very great compromises took place, as you can absolutely predict from such books as Judges. Each generation has to discover the Lord all over again. God doesn't have any grandchildren. There has to be every generation, every individual, a turning to the Lord, regeneration, obedience. We can't depend on what our fathers and grandfathers and ancestors did. You can absolutely predict that it's downhill from here. Now, of course, the book of Ezra gives you maybe a 60-year gap during which the events of the book of Esther occurred. And then, of course, Ezra came back with several thousand more Jews, and he found incredible corruption, intermarriages and so forth, even in the part of the leaders and the priests, with pagans, Gentiles. And then Nehemiah came back and found even more horrible things happening. And so it went. Now, friends, as you think of Zechariah, this young prophet of God to whom he gave eight night visions and a symbolic act that are described in the earlier chapters, particularly Zechariah chapters 1 through 6, and then some interesting things that happen in chapters 7 and 8 as God sent to them some very concerned ceremonial legalists from the north, from Bethel, who wanted to know, how long do we have to keep up this if the temple is now being built? And the amazing prophecies God gave in response to that in chapter 7 and 8. Zechariah, friends, by the time the temple was actually finished, must have wondered in his heart, is this all there is? You see, he knew something. Let's be very open about this. Zechariah knew something. He knew what Ezekiel had prophesied. Do you know what Ezekiel had said a generation earlier? Why, he said that the temple would be stupendous, magnificent, and all the nations of the world would come to worship God there. That there'd be tremendous geographical changes. The Dead Sea would be lifted up so high it would become fresh water. Ezekiel 47. Oh. And before that, he had said in chapters 38 and 9 that Gog from Magog would come down and be supernaturally destroyed, and the nation of Israel would never again be threatened by Gentile people. And before that, in Ezekiel 37, the Valley of Dry Bones, the whole nation would be revived like a resurrection from the dead. And Judah and Israel would be reunited by God. And before that, Ezekiel 36, the people would be regenerated by God, like clean water sprinkled upon them. They would be cleansed and purified, regenerated, born again, not individually here and there like Nicodemus and a few people, but the whole nation saved. He said all Israel will be saved, just like Paul reminded his readers in Romans 11. Oh, really? Well, where are we now? We're an absolutely pitiful, puny, twinsy, little remnant surrounded by an ocean of godless, pagan, polytheistic Gentiles. Where is Ezekiel's prophecies? See, there was a lot to be thankful for when the second temple was built. But friends, it was so pitiful compared even to Solomon's temple that some of the old-timers who'd remembered the previous temple and saw this one actually wept at the contrast. It was embarrassing. It was shocking. Where are Ezekiel's prophecies? Well, I don't think he was a post-millennial spiritualizer. I think he began to wonder, well, maybe this was not the return that God prophesied would happen. Maybe something is going to have to happen before Messiah comes back. And then, would you agree with me, he doubtless consulted the book of Daniel too. In fact, we know that he knew Daniel, don't we? Because in Ezekiel 14, he mentions Daniel twice. Even if Job and Noah and Daniel were in Jerusalem, said God through Ezekiel, I would never restore the city. And Ezekiel 28, he compared the arrogant, proud king of Tyre with Daniel. Oh, you think you're wiser than Daniel? You see, Daniel was internationally known for his fantastic, incomparable wisdom because he interpreted the dream. He not only interpreted Nebuchadnezzar's dream in 603 BC, he told him what it was. He told him the dream first, then told him what it meant. Nebuchadnezzar said, this is it. You're number one. And his fame spread throughout the entire world of that day. So I hope you'll agree with me that not only did Ezekiel know about Daniel, but so did Zechariah. And here's what he knew about Daniel's prophecies. He knew, friends, that there would have to be 69 weeks of years before Messiah came. That's right. Messiah's coming. As we see in 516, the temple was completed through the preaching, the prophesying of Zerubbabel and Joshua, and then later through the tremendous ministries of Ezra and then Nehemiah, and then together, on one occasion at least, even the walls of the city were rebuilt. God had said, you see, to Nehemiah, chapter 2 of his amazing book, that from the going forth of the decree to rebuild Jerusalem with a moat around it, I mean a wall around it, see, not just to reoccupy it, as had been done with Zerubbabel and Joshua, to rebuild the walls would be 7 weeks and 62 weeks, heptads, shavuim, units of 7 years. Guess how many years that adds up to? 483. And when that day would arrive, which turns out to be about 33 AD, according to Daniel, Messiah would be cut off and have nothing. He'd be cut off. Very fascinating. You mean there's going to be centuries before this is all going to happen? Yet before, not before the kingdom, before even the Messiah comes. And even when he comes, he'd be cut off and die. Little did Zechariah know, or Daniel, or Ezekiel, or Isaiah, that between the cutting off of Messiah by an apostate Israel and the actual appearance of Messiah as King of Kings and Lord of Lords to establish the kingdom on earth would be what is already almost 2,000 more years. I'm sure those prophets would have been utterly depressed to think of the enormous amount of time that would elapse before their dreams, that were well-informed dreams, mind you, not dreams that we think about that are completely non-authoritative, but dreams and visions God gave to prophets that were infallible, before any of that could ever really be fulfilled. Vast periods of time would elapse. Well, friends, that's the scenario, you see, that Zechariah faced. How does tiny, puny, feeble, little Israel in the Holy Land, a mere remnant of what's still in Babylonia — those Babylonian Jews were so wealthy and so affluent by now and so self-satisfied, they couldn't possibly have been less interested than in going back to impoverished Palestine, fighting all kinds of enemies, Sanballats, Tobias, and name them all. Why bother? And the same attitude, I'm sure, is felt by millions of Jews in America today. New York, Miami, Los Angeles, name it all. Why go back to Israel? The constant threats, the terrorism, the economic struggles, why bother? See, something supernatural has to happen, friends, to bring every living Jew back to that promised land. And that'll happen in a scenario that God unfolds here and there, now and then, throughout the prophetic writings of the Bible. And happen it will. Unbelievable, inexplicable, but it will happen. God's ways past finding out. But they'll happen. Now that, friends, is essential background, you see, for what we're going to read now. Turn with me, please, to Zechariah chapter 9. The burden of the word of the Lord. And that word burden means something that is just heavy with judgment. Something is going to be revealed here that's going to bring about the destruction of vast numbers of people. The burden of the word of the Lord. You'll see the second three chapters we'll be looking at, God willing, this week, starts exactly the same way. Chapter 12, verse 1, the burden of the word of the Lord. These are the two, three-chapter segments that we'll be studying together. And I announce in advance, dear friends, again, the very heavy problems we'll face in interpreting some of these verses. This is very complex prophetic material. So please allow the Spirit of God to be your teacher too. Don't despise these passages by saying, well, they're so difficult, I don't even think I'll bother. You see, many people use that excuse, that attitude, to dismiss reading any of the Bible at all. Peter, I think, was tempted to say about the same thing of Paul's epistles. He said, in which are some things hard to be understood, which the ignorant and the unstable twist as they do the other scriptures to their own destruction. That's very serious, folks.
You're listening to Zechariah the Lord Remembers and Encounter God's Truth from Whitcomb Ministries. Visit us online at whitcombministries.org. We want to express our appreciation to Middletown Bible Church in Middletown, Connecticut, for permission to share this series of messages that Dr. Whitcomb first presented at a Bible conference there. Remember, you can always hear this program again at sermonaudio.com/Whitcomb. You'll even find some additional resources there from the book of Zechariah. Just search for them in our sermon library. We'll resume this presentation next time. In the meantime, please keep in touch with us on our social media pages, facebook.com/Whitcomb Ministries and myworldview.com/Whitcomb Ministries. Until then, I'm Wayne Shepherd, reminding you that the Lord remembers. Thanks for joining us today on Encounter God's Truth.